Accession number 19775, Real One.
Colonel Massey, Real One. Where were you born, please?
Detroit, Michigan.
Which year was this?
1913.
Could you tell me a little about your family background? Because I don't really think it's American, is it?
No, I'm Anglo-Irish origin, and my family have been in and around Canada for some years, and there's never enough money at home, so they had to go abroad, and my father went to Canada and part of a banking concern, and I was born in Detroit because my parents thought the facilities there were better. My father died when I was a year old, leaving my mother with a rather difficult time and not very much money and a world war to contend with, because she came straight home to England when her husband died.
Could you tell me a little about the Anglo-Irish background, please?
Well, my family were of Norman origin, and they went to Ireland in 1661 and were part of the Protestant invasion under the Commonwealth, and they were later supported there under William and Mary, and they were given a large amount of land in Southern Ireland, which the local Irish didn't entirely agree with, so they looked after their own and the Hanoverian interests with a great deal of energy, for which one of them was created a baron in 1776, and we stemmed from that.
Where was the family seat in Ireland?
In County Limerick. And my family in those days used to live all around Limerick and Tipperary. And I've been to look at the house I was brought up in before I went to school. And it's a nice house 7 miles outside Tipperary town. And when you stand in front of the front door, which is a portico type of thing, with wings on either side, it's interesting looking up at the windows, which are enfiladed for rifles, which you don't get in Surrey or Sussex.
What is the name of the house?
Cadangan Manor. And my uncle lived in my part of the family's main building, which was a place called Carvla Howe in the Golden Vale, which is now a racing stable.
Did you live in Ireland yourself for any length?
Only until 1922. I was there during the troubles in 22 as a small boy, and then I went to school. My mother married again, although her marriage didn't last very long, but she never went back to Ireland.
What happened to the family during the troubles in 22?
Well, I was in the house of my cousin Hugh Townsend, who was a couple of years older than me, and we shared a governess together. And one night we were hauled out of bed, wrapped up in eiderdowns, and taken down to the kitchen through the green baize door, while my uncle was being interrogated by the Sinn Féin as to where his guns were. Fortunately, they'd gone in to the barracks in Tipperary about a week before, but the Sinn Féin didn't know that, and we were all in the servants' side of the house, with my aunt not really helping by saying there's nothing but savages live here now, and she had 12 Pekingeses, and they had to be locked up in the butler's pantry for fear of them savaging the Sinn Féiners. We weren't burnt down because the head Sinn Féiner in that part was my uncle's head gardener, and he didn't want to lose his job.
Were these men known to the family?
Oh, yes. They were quite friendly. The people who did the damage were all people who came from New York or Cork.
And that raid was in 1922, was it?
21, actually.
And did the family decide to leave Ireland?
Yes, it upset my aunt a great deal, and she made her husband, who was the agent to Lord Barrymore, made him leave Ireland, go and live in Italy for a bit. But they went back to Ireland later on. They lived in what was then Queenstown, now Cobh.
Where did you have your schooling?
I went to Harrow after prep school, which I rather enjoyed.
What was so enjoyable about it?
I can't think, really. But I know I had a happy boyhood. I got paratyphoid when I was at my prep school and was in bed for nearly a year. And as a result, I wasn't allowed to play games for my first 2 years at Harrow. And of course, in those days, if you were a non-games player, you tended to be a non-person. So my first 2 years were not happy. But then I happened to take part in the boxing and won the heavyweight boxing, and life changed overnight. From then on, it was sheer bliss at Harrow because all doors were then open to one. In those days, you happened to be a heavyweight boxer at school, you were somebody.
How much did you weigh when you were a teenager?
I was a light heavy.
And how tall were you?
When I got to Sandhurst, I was about 6'4".
Why did you decide to go in for an army career?
Well, there wasn't really anything else I could do. I wasn't particularly bright. I just got my 5 school certificates, which was the minimum that you needed. My mother really couldn't afford to send me to a university, and I don't think I was a university type. I had no family. My Irish connections were no help, and my mother's family was no help because my grandfather was dead and my grandmother lived in Clifton, wasn't particularly interested in children. And for my type of boy, really the army was the only thing. And in those days it wasn't particularly difficult to get in because very few people wanted to join the army. I went to Burlington House for an interview with an admiral, a general and an air marshal. And the general said to me, "Why do you want to join the army?" And I said, "Because I like horses." He said, "And very good reason too." So I went to Sandhurst.
What kind of experience did you have there?
Well, I had a friend who'd been at Harrow with me, who was an under officer, who came to see me. He gave me some good advice. He said, "You don't want to be an NCO here. They do all the dirty jobs. You either want to be a gentleman cadet or an under officer." So I said, "What are the pros and cons?" And he said, "Well, under officers don't have to warn in or out when they go to London. Gentlemen cadets do." So I said, "Well, I could be an under officer, please." And he said, "Well, there are some preliminaries. First thing is you must get a stripe off the square, which means you must be a right marker." And so the next day when we paraded in front of an escort, Sergeant Cop of the Coast Stream Guards, who said, "Shoulders on the left, shoulders on the right," I was next door to a chap who went in the Scots Guards, who was about 8 foot tall. But I managed to persuade him that I could give him an inch or two, so I was right marker, and he was left marker. We both got stripes off the square, and that was the first thing towards becoming an under officer, and then I had to get a boxing blue, which is the other thing, so I became an under officer. and I could go to London.
What was the attraction of London for you?
I had a lady friend there who liked to see me. I liked to see her.
So this was the early 30s, was it?
This was the early 30s. I went to India when I was 19 in 1932. And I was attached to the King's Shropshire Light Infantry in Rawalpindi and the KSLI. Their officers had all been born in Hereford or Shropshire and had known each other since birth. And the soldiers all came from the Welsh valleys and were called Jones, except for my sergeant, who was Sergeant Pratt, who I fear is no use to him, though he taught me a lot. Funny life in the British Army before the war. If you wanted a drink, you would send for a mess waiter and ask him to give your compliments to the senior subaltern, who was Geoffrey Musson, and say you wanted to buy yourself a beer. And if Geoffrey wasn't pleased with it, which was quite often, he'd say no. And the other, all sorts of odd things looking back. Drawing the pay for a battalion in the 30s, soldiers were paid in silver rupees on a Friday. And if you happened to be orderly officer, you went down to the Imperial Bank of India with a section of soldiers and a sergeant and an AT cart with a box in it, in which you put the money for the return journey. You cashed your cheque in the bank, which a lot of rupees and a sack were given to, and you went out on the steps of the bank, and with the aid of the sergeant, you rang them, each one. About 10% were done. You took those back into the bank, they gave you some more, and you went on doing this till you thought you had 100% good rupees. Then you went back, and the men were paid. If any man found that he had a bad rupee, he was given a good one, and you know who paid. Other odd things. I bought a car while I was with the KSLI. It cost about £5 and was a snub-nosed Morris Minor. I wish I had it now. It had a wickerwork seat for the dickey, and the door shut with a piece of string over a nail. Second time I took it out, the steering broke, and I ended up in hospital on a Monday. None of the doctors were back from their weekend leave, so the orderly looked at my swollen ankle, prescribed cold water bandages, massage, and a spell in the junior officer's ward. The PT sergeant who came to give me my massage was luckily a rather fat man, and he never caught me as I sped round the ward on my crutches, urged on by my fellow officers. Luckily, my posting to Hodson's Horse arrived in the middle of this, and I reported to the adjutant and apologized for the crutches, and he sent me off to the Indian Military Hospital in Sialkote, where the doctors are rather better. They were paid more, and they didn't have to be Irish. And the one who looked at me asked for the x-ray, then told there wasn't one, had my ankle photographed, saw the break, put plaster around it, and I spent the first 2 or 3 weeks of my time in the Indian Army, sitting in the mess garden of Hodson's Horse, admiring the flowers and being fed crumpets by the old Abdar.
Whereabouts had the KSLI been based in India?
They were in Rawalpindi, in northern India. They'd just come back from a war in Waziristan, and they were fairly peaceful when I was there.
Why had you chosen the Indian Army?
Well, I could have gone to my family regiment, which was the Enniskillens, or to the Queen's Bays, which was in those days said to be for poor subalterns, or I could have gone to India. And on the amount of money you needed to have a small allowance in those days to join a cavalry regiment, and my mother could give me 200 a year, which meant I was fairly well off in India, though I wouldn't have been particularly well off in England, and as all British regiments ended up in India sooner or later, that's why I went.
What were Hodgson's horse equipped with in the mid-30s?
Hodgson's horse was 100% ready for the First World War. They were equipped with rifles and sabres. Each troop had a Bren-like machine gun, and there were four Vickers guns in regimental headquarters squadron. Signals were by flag and lamp, and as I say, we were fully prepared for the First World War. Our aircraft and tanks we'd heard of, but we very seldom saw. Just before the Second World War started, we were issued with a green flag with a white cross on it, which we were told would represent an anti-tank gun. And if you gave one of these to a simple soldier, he tended to think they were magic.
What kind of men were in Hodgson's horse when you were with them in the 30s?
We had three sabre squadrons, one of Sikhs, one of Punjabi Muslims, and one of Hindu Dogras. And of course a headquarters squadron mixed of all three. I was in the PM squadron and was very fond of my Mohammedan.
Were the three different classes readily distinguishable in their characteristics from each other?
Yes, part of the fact that they all wore different type of pagri, so that you knew which was which without having to ask. The Sikhs were better educated and more on the ball than the other two squadrons. In all sports, it was the Sikh squadron you had to beat. The PMs were good, solid chaps, never particularly outstanding, but always reliable. And the Dogras, if you put a Dogra in a position and told him to hold it, his eyes would go red and he'd be there until the end of time. They were wonderful people to soldier with.
What did their attitude towards you and the other officers seem to be?
Well, when I first arrived, I was 20, obviously knew nothing. I was a second lieutenant, and therefore senior, in theory, to the Viceroy's commissioned officers. But my senior VCO, Risseldar Ghulam Yassin, was really an uncle to me, I suppose. Mervyn Vigers, my CO, used to give orders on manoeuvres, and I go back to issue what I believe to be the right thing to do to my troop leaders. And I'd see Ghulam Yassin going back, talking very fast to the troop leaders. Then the squadron would come out and quite often do something quite different to what I thought they were going to do. And bit by bit I learned from the fact that Ghulam Hussein knew what ought to be done and told them what to do. But nobody ever disagreed with my orders. They just didn't do them. After a bit I began to get the hang of it, and Ghulam Hussein no longer had to tell the troop leaders what to do. It was a very, very brilliant system, actually. Nobody lost any face, and provided you were reasonably receptive, you learned.
Was there much regimental pride?
Oh, yes. All the soldiers are terribly proud to be in Hodgson's Horse, and Hodgson's Horse had actually a very good record. They'd been raised by a subaltern in the mutiny, who died in the relief of Lucknow. In the First World War, they'd been in the trenches at Givenchy in December 1914. And I doubt if today you could get a regiment of horse cavalry to France in that length of time. And they were in France until the Americans joined in the war. 1917, they went off to Palestine and took part in Allenby's push to Damascus. There was the 9th Hotson's Horse, who had a really very distinguished First World War. The 10th Hotson's Horse went to Mesopotamia in 1916, and because of the Arab Rebellion, they were there till 1922. They came back to India in time to be amalgamated with the 9th, and they became the 4th Hodson's Horse.
How many units of Hodson's Horse were there in India when you served?
Only one, just the 4th. But they had in it people who'd served in either the 9th or the 10th. My CO was Mervyn Vigers, who'd been in the 9th. He'd got his MC in France and his DSO in Palestine. He was an 8-handicap polo player. He was a brilliant horseman, brilliant shot. He did everything very well. The men feared and adored him and would have followed him anywhere, and so would I. He used to have enormously high standards, which I found very difficult to get anywhere near. And I'd be in the depths of despond when his wife Daphne would turn up and ask me to tea, and then it'd be all right again. It was a very good family regiment. Thursdays, as you know, were a holiday in India, and my first Thursday in the regiment, I didn't get up very early. And I went into breakfast, and another officer came and said, "Hello, where have you been this morning?" I said, "I was observing the holiday." "Oh," he said, "you observe the holiday on parade, you know." And Hodson's Horse used to have mounted sports on Thursday morning, and the regiment used to be competing against each other in show jumping or tent pegging or tug of war or whatever, and the mess would be there serving iced coffee and wives. It was a very happy family regiment.
Did you see anything of civil disturbance in India pre-1939?
No, I never did. Hodson's Horse, when they had been in Kohat, which was a station before Sialkote, and that was before I joined, had had to deal with the Red Shirt trouble, who were Mohammedans, who had a leader in the Northwest Frontier province, and they paraded, and they used to sit down on the road and couldn't be budged. And horses, of course, won't go up to a heap of rags in the middle of the road, and it was very difficult to do anything about it. And my squadron leader, Johnny Walker, was scratching his head wondering how to move these people, when his subedar, his wrestledar, Ghulam Hussein, said to him, "Sahib, leave it to me." So Johnny said, "Okay." So the soldiers went up and urinated on the red shirts, and that moved them straight away.
And did you have a spell on the frontier?
Not till later, when I was in Northern Ireland, which was a very tame frontier. The frontier further north from Lorelei was, of course, where you had much rougher Pathans, and we had the Baluchis were very quiet. I did go up to Abbottabad in about 1934, I suppose, when I was... The thing about India was that in the summer, you had to have four British officers present with the regiment. Looking back on it, it's always seemed to me that in a country which I'm now told was in seething with discontent, that you would get away with four officers in a regiment and nobody minded. But that's all you had to have, and it meant that one was officiating this and that. I was officiating adjutant and officiating squadron leader at the age of 22, which was wonderful training. And the adjutant was responsible for training recruits and remounts. And the remounts, once they'd been passed fit for the ranks, went into the polo ride if they were any good at all. I know that some people describe Indian Cavalry regiments as government-sponsored polo clubs, but in actual fact, because one was mounted on a horse with a sabre, you were looking forward to taking part in a charge. The arm launch was what cavalry was about, and you used to practice charging on an enormous parade ground in Selkirk. Orders used to be by trumpet, and one would say to one's trumpet, squadron trumpeter, "Woke ear high, what's that mean?" And he'd say, whatever it was, and you'd give the required order, and only hope he was right, because otherwise there could be a shambles with everybody going along at a gallop. And polo, of course, is the only game played where you have to think at the gallop, which is why it's good for a cavalry regiment and why it was popular in India. Anyway, I took, when I was acting adjutant, I went on leave to Abbottabad, which was a hill station on the frontier, where they played faster polo because it's higher up than was possible in the sweltering plains. And I suppose I went up there with about 12 ponies. And when I got there, I discovered that the Abbottabad Brigade was out in the Black Mountains dealing with the the tribesmen there who were rebelling about something. So every polo day I used to go to the staff captain's office, and he'd ring up the brigade major, who would ring back a bit and say, "The brigadier thinks the battle will end by about 1 o'clock, and we can play at 2:30. And all the polo playing officers would come back from the column, play polo, have tea in a bath, and go back and join their units for the night. And I thought, what a wonderful way of fighting a war, what a sensible way of running an empire.
At that time in India, had you anticipated that a world war might soon break out?
Well, of course, I'd thought that things weren't going to be all that easy when I was at Sandhurst. When Hitler marched into the Ruhr, the senior instructor, talking to the intermediate term, said, "Don't think that soldiering is going to be all fox hunting and dancing, because it isn't. From now on, you're going to be required to lead the country." And when I came out of the lecture, I said to the chap next to me, "If the Daily Mirror got hold of this, that chap would be for the high jump," because, of course, England was very pacifist at that time. Indeed, I think I was too.